You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your mind and with all your spirit and all of your strength. This is the first commandment, and the second is like unto it. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. The problem with today's gospel reading is we've heard it too many times. Again and again and again. More than once a year, usually. And because we've heard it so many times, it just seems like the obvious answer to the question. We don't hear the bite in it. We don't hear the sting in it. We don't hear the controversy in it. We don't hear the challenge in it. To get that, we have to go back to the time of Jesus and understand the depth of this question. Jesus, the scribe asks, what's most important? What's most important? What is most important? In the Jewish scriptures, there were over 600 laws. There were over 600 rules. There were over 600 ways of ordering one's life. And of these 600, like, what's the overarching principle? What is the most important thing that helps govern all of them? How do we order them and understand them? And there were many to choose from. But Jesus, when he chose the one that was the most obvious, the safest, the one that most people would have agreed to. He quoted a verse from Deuteronomy that was sort of the foundation, the rallying cry for Judaism. Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God, the Lord is one. And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and with all your strength. When Jesus said that, everyone in the room's going, yes, of course, that makes perfect sense. The fact that our God is one and that we love our God with all of our being, that's the ordering principle. The question that begs is, what does it mean to love God? What does it look like to love God? What do we do to love God? That first sentence, it's sort of a non-answer. It's like the apple pie answer. Love God and apple pie. You know, but what does that look like? What does it mean if we are an apple pie loving people? Like, what does it mean if we are a God loving people? And the way that was answered in Judaism, for the most part, the foundation of Judaism, had to do with being holy. Leviticus writes, be holy as God is holy. And then in Leviticus, it talks about holiness in terms of purity. Be a distinct people. Be a different kind of people by living a life of holiness and purity. And then the other, 600 plus laws are there to help you understand how to be pure and how not to become unclean by associating or touching the wrong things or eating the wrong foods. And then also how to become clean or be cleaned if you eat some of the wrong things or touch some of the wrong people by going to the temple and offering sacrifices. It laid out this whole way of living so that you can be more pure and more holy. And that was the foundation for much of the Jewish religion. And there was a way in which answering the question, loving God means following the rules. Follow the rules is how you love God. The problem with that way of being is that you can follow the rules. You can follow all of the rules. You can be completely holy and still be a jerk. Right? You can follow all of the rules and be pure and still lead a life that is cruel toward other people. And within Judaism, while the main trajectory was about holiness and purity, there was another voice. And this other voice within Judaism was about compassion. And it was the message that was proclaimed by the prophets. What the prophets said was, I despise your solemn assemblies. I despise your feasts. I don't care. care about your worship and your singing, if you're not caring for the poor and the outcast and the least and the lost and the widow and the orphan. That message of compassion and care and concern was present in Judaism, but it was more of a minor chord. It was the protest message against the major message of be pure as I am pure. Be holy as I am holy. And when Jesus came along, what he did when he answered the question, love the Lord your God with all your being, he connected that to love your neighbor as yourself. What it looks like to love God is to love your neighbor. And love, in the biblical context, is not a sweet and tender feeling. Love, in the biblical context, has to do with commitment to the well-being of the other. And the neighbor is bigger than the person next to you. So what Jesus was doing was standing firmly in that prophetic tradition, saying, all of this doesn't matter if you're not living a life of compassion and love and action to the least and the lost and the broken. So it's not so much about the rules as it is about the love. So when I was a fairly new priest, I was a brand new rector. It was my first time leading a congregation. I was in Idaho in a church. And a young woman came to see me. It was the late 90s, to put this in our social context. A young woman came to see me. She was about 26. She was very devout. She was a devout Christian. She was a devout Episcopalian. And she made an appointment to come see the Episcopal priest because she had a question she needed answered. So she sits down in my office and she says to me, I need to know from the perspective of the church who I can marry. And I say, I need a little more information. And she says, well, I'm intersex, which means I have the physical characteristics of both a man and a woman. And it seems that whoever I marry, I'm gay. Well, the first thing that pops in my mind was, well, if you flip the equation, anyone you marry, you're not gay. But anyway, that's not going to be a helpful thing to say because she has this burden on her heart. And part of the burden on her heart is, well, first of all, like I am trying to quell like the fact that my mind's exploding in this conversation, right? But the burden on her heart has to do with the debate that was raging in the church at the time around the place of people who were gay and lesbian. And this was the late 90s, which means the church was pretty far down the road in our conversation. We were ordaining gay and lesbian people. We had an advocacy organization, Integrity. There was a lot of material about scripture and all of that stuff. And the church has gone pretty far down that road, and she wasn't aware of those resources. So I let her know that, you know, here's where the church is, and here are some resources where you can learn more about the conversation around people who were gay and lesbian. But that was only tangential, right, to her real issue. Her real issue was, where am I located? Where are people who are intersex located in the Episcopal Church? Now, I had no idea. So I did what any good priest would do in that situation. Well, actually, the first thing would be I'll pray on it, but I didn't do that. I didn't say that. What I said was, so in the Episcopal Church, things are raging about sexuality issues, and we're having all kinds of conversations. And at the time, the House of Bishops were meeting three times a year to talk through things. So I'm thinking maybe this conversation has come up in the House of Bishops. And it just happened that my bishop was going to be visiting just a few days later. So I said, you know, the bishop's coming, the House of Bishops are talking about all kinds of things, so let me ask the bishop, because surely the bishop will know the answer to this question. That's what I meant by the thing any good priest would do, would be to ask the bishop. So she was like, cool, thank you for the information. I'll learn more about the gay stuff, and I'll wait for your answer after you talk with the bishop. So the bishop comes, Bishop of Idaho, John Thornton, sits down in front of me in my office, and I say, Bishop Thornton, woman comes to see me, intersex, physical characteristics. I'm explaining the situation to her, and I could tell by the look on her face that the House of Bishops has never discussed this. This is a totally new world for him. And his response was first silence. He sat in silence for 3 minutes at least, just sat in silence. And then after this long period of silence, takes a breath, and he goes, Brian, I suppose life for these people is hard enough already. The church shouldn't make it any harder. And that's all he said. Basically what he was saying, like he didn't give a ruling, he didn't say do this. What he said was do the loving thing. Do the loving thing. Which is harder than following a rule, like doing the loving thing, wrestling with what is the loving thing in each and every context as our world is changing so quickly, what is the loving thing? But that's the challenge of the gospel. It's not about following rules so that we're holy or pure. It's entering into the muck and the mess and the hard and the challenge and the complexity of the world, always striving to do the loving thing, to care about the well-being of the person in front of us as much as we care about ourselves, as much as we respond to the needs of us and our children, we need to engage the needs. We need to care about and respond to the needs of others. That's the challenge that this passage is trying to get us to wrestle with. And that, I'm proud to say, was the guiding principle of our church's journey through wrestling with issues of human sexuality as we move from being confused and troubled to a place where we embraced, accepted marriage equality, and now it's pretty much a non-issue to do the loving thing. That's in our church, much a lot non-issue. But there are new issues. We live in a new world. We live in a world that seems to be getting even more complicated and more scary. The arguments become like higher stakes arguments. And once again, we're confronted with this challenge of how do we apply this love principle in the world that we're living in now, the world that is going nuts. Like this world that is on fire. How do we respond in a loving way when the stakes are getting higher? And as I think about like this tension, this tense place we're in right now as a nation and as a society, and I think about how to respond in a loving way, for me, there are three things that come to mind. One has to do, well, let me back up. Part of what's happening in this world, like our moment right now, is we're at this moment where there's this mind-blowing awakening to the challenges that minorities and populations face. This mind-blowing awakening to race and racism in our culture and how that has infected us. This mind-blowing opening, at least for some of us, for others it was obvious, but for some of us, the level of misogyny, the level of sexual harassment that is becoming known to more of us because of the Me Too movement, there is this consciousness opening that's happening in our culture and this responsiveness. And at the same time, there is this rise in hatred and sort of narrowness and tribalism and circling the wagons and violence. We're at this time where things are just like ripping apart and opening, and And it's scary and it's confusing. And for me, I feel called to three responses. One is to pay more attention to the voice of the people who are scared, and to be responsive to the people who are scared and expressing like their woundedness over this, to be responsive to the voice of the racial minority, to people of color, to immigrants, to women, and to be responsive. And for example, right now there's heightened anxiety and fear among people who are Jewish because of the shooting that happened in a synagogue last week. And there are opportunities when something like that happens in every community in the U.S. There are vigils that are happening. There are events happening in synagogues where you can show up and let your Jewish neighbors know that you have their back and they're not alone. That matters. And to tell your Jewish friends, "I'm sorry. How can I help? I have your back." So the tragic good news is we're always given opportunities to show up for people who are terrified, because people in our neighborhoods are being terrified by what's happening. So one piece is to show up for people who are sort of on the wounding end of dialogues that are happening and the conversation and the chaos that's happening in our nation. The second, for me, has to do with the fact that I am scared. I'm scared about what's happening to our country. I am scared about what's happening to our culture. I'm scared about the values that I hold so dear just being tossed to the side and us sort of dying as a culture. I'm scared. And I know that I'm not my best self when I'm scared. When I'm afraid, it's harder for me to listen to the better angels of my nature. It's harder for me to bring my better self to the conversation. And there are only two things I know to counter fear. One is to get involved in something that seems to be helping, like have some agency, have some sense of control. The other, and for me it's becoming more and more important, I'm embarrassed to say, the other is prayer. And I'm praying more now than I've ever prayed. I'm embarrassed that I haven't prayed this much before, but it's never too late. So I'm praying more now than I ever did before, because prayer connects me to something. And in reality, this is not the first time the world has gone crazy. In reality, this is not the first time our culture has been in upheaval and turmoil. We just have bad memories. And because this is happening now, it feels like it's the end of the world. But this is not the first time. And it's not the worst time. It's been worse. It's just our time. And what prayer does is it connects me with God and lets me know that God is present in all of this and God's will be done. It also connects me with generations that have gone before. Generations that have gone before that have weathered these kinds of times and come out stronger on the other side. And I want to come out stronger on the other side rather than come out of this cowering under my bed. So to do that, I need to pray. And the third thing is, there's one way in which this call to love your neighbor has us think of the big groups that we need to love. And in some sense, that's sort of that lets us off the hook from loving. Like when Jesus said, love our neighbor, it means everyone, but it also means your neighbor. So the third thing is to love your neighbor. Not just the generic person in need, but the person that lives next to you whose dog poops on your lawn. Right? How do we love more? How are we more responsive? How do we put ourselves in the place of those around us and respond to the needs of the person sitting next to you or living next to you or sitting around you? The other thing is, don't just get lost in sort of the global anxiety. When you have a way of enacting Jesus' will, God's will, to living more in the kingdom of heaven right next to you. So for me, that's the third thing, is to pay attention. I need to be responsive to the groups of people who are being wounded and stand up and show up. I also need to pray and get connected to the will of God and the Spirit of God to decrease my anxiety, to realize I'm part of a cloud of witnesses that have been here before, and we will get through this and God's will be done. And then I need to look at the people that show up in my life that I encounter on a daily basis and ask, how can I do better? How can I be more engaged and more loving? For me, when we do that, when we loosen and let go of some of that fear, when we show up to support people and to tell people we're there for them and to like fight against the evil, and when we respond tangibly to the needs of those around us, it's in those moments that I know in my heart that we are not far from the kingdom of God. Amen.